Hello, everybody. Nicholas Snow here. The title of today's show, LGBTQ Civil Rights, The Critical Role of Decades of Media Activism. It is July 15th, 2015 at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, but this show remains available in perpetuity. My guest today is someone that I have known, I'm getting around 25 years. If I'm off, it's only by a few years. Kathy Renna, I refer to her as a fellow media activist. I don't know if she would call herself a media activist, but that's a term I'm going to give her until she corrects me if she does. She's currently a managing partner at Target Q, an LGBT and HIV-focused public interest PR and communications firm. Kathy has played a critical role in media related to nearly every issue affecting LGBTQ populations, from high visibility issues like marriage equality and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to being the force behind creating more visibility for older LGBT people, homeless LGBT youth, transgender youth, and a host of other populations and issues. In the 1990s through 2003, Kathy was a major force behind the success and growth of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, most commonly referred to as GLAAD. Find them at glaad.org, GLAAD.org. You know, I could say so much more about Kathy, but I want to refer you to her official website. So if you go to targetq.com and click on the Who We Are section, you get to find out all sorts of exciting information about my fabulous guest today, and I'll be bringing her on in just a few minutes. I also wanted to remind you that when you're listening to the show live, you can call in. The call-in number is always 347-215-8866. Everything related to the show is available at nicholassnowlive.com. And I am also in the process, I have a very active YouTube channel already, but I've come up with a way for you to find it easily. Just go to nicholassnow.tv. It takes you right to the YouTube channel. And I'm very excited because from the year 1993 to about 2000, I had a public access TV show called Tinseltown's Queer. It morphed into the Nicholas Snow Show during the last year. At any rate, I'm bringing that show out of the closet, and I'm going to begin digitizing the entire series for the YouTube channel to share with the world because it's historic in nature. There's really amazing footage. Among that footage is a live performance that I did at the Cine Grill in Hollywood of a civil rights anthem that I wrote. It's called Stonewalls. I recently digitized that video, and I'm going to conclude today's show with the audio of my live performance of Stonewalls, which actually was recorded 18 years ago. So we have a very exciting, inspiring show for you because, as you know, the LGBTQ civil rights movement has made astounding progress. And my guest today is one of the reasons why, one of millions of the reasons why, but she was there all along, at least in the last few decades. So I'll be back soon with Kathy Renna.
I want to give a big shout out of thanks to all my advertisers. You'll hear the commercials during the show. If this episode had a presenting sponsor, you would be hearing their commercial right now at the beginning of the show. For information on how to secure this sponsorship, or for the contact information for all my advertisers, visit NicholasSnowLive.com and click on the advertisers link in the main submenu. Spotlight on Palm Springs.
Come to Lulu, the award-winning California bistro. Fabulous breakfast, a luscious three-course Sunday brunch, scrumptious dinners serving fresh fish, perfect steaks, pizzas, salads, and more. Something for everyone. A three-course special to savor from $15.99. The best all-day and night happy hour. There's always a party at Lulu in the heart of downtown Palm Springs on South Palm Canyon and Arenas.
New designer furnishings, sparkling cocktail rings, vintage jeans and shirts for moms, teens, boys, and flirts. Area patio rugs and stylish bedding, design your wedding. Shiny knickknacks and glam Hollywood throwbacks. You'll find it here at Revivals. Voted best of the Valley thrift stores. Now with even more new treasures, plus one-of-a-kind consignment and estate items. Fashion, accessories, furniture, it's all in store at Revivals. Find it here. Visit us at RevivalStores.com to find a Revivals store near you.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Snow. Many of you know that I am HIV positive. I'm living powerfully with HIV because I benefit from the services of the Desert AIDS Project in Palm Springs, California. And I'm very happy to bring you this news from another grateful client of Desert AIDS Project.
I'm more proactive with my health now, I think, than I was before. And I think that's because there's other people that are being proactive with me. You know, there's people that are interested and concerned about it.
A lot of services that are very difficult to access to HIV-infected patients are gathered within one roof. We do have access to substance abuse counselor, mental health services, psychiatrists. We have dental service programs. We have nutritional programs, housing, case management. Very unique in the nation that all the programs, including medical services, are administered within one facility.
Coming here, I felt just an amazing amount of love from Desert AIDS Project. They are people who just care in the community, people who want to put a hand out and say, let me hold yours. And I think that makes all the difference in the world.
For more information, visit desertaidsproject.org.
And now, on with the snow, show, celebrating his fourth decade as a multimedia entertainment activist. Reaching millions of people worldwide, Nicholas is definitely a leading primo promo homo on the go-go. Yes, over 6 feet of snow has just drifted into your podcast experience. And here he is, Nicholas Snow.
Hey, everybody. The fourth year of my podcast began this month, which means that the show's been on for just over 3 years. And I want to thank you. You know, a lot of people, they throw out statistics that are sort of self-aggrandizing. But I like to tell you how my statistics say that three times fast are based on. So, you know, my little promo there says that I reach millions of people worldwide. Well, I've been a media activist for decades, but just in the last 3 years on this podcast, this week, I surpassed 1.8 million cumulative listens. So I want to thank you for that. I mentioned that my guest today is Kathy Renna, and I'm just going to bring her right on the show because we've talked about her enough without her. Kathy, I'm so excited you are on the show. I couldn't be more delighted.
I am absolutely thrilled to reconnect and talk to you.
Speaking of reconnection, the power of Facebook, you know, I have known you for a long, long time and recently discovered you on Facebook. And I have just loved the front row seat you have provided to some of the most amazing twists and turns of our movement since weeks and months.
I so enjoy Facebook. And it's funny when you were talking before and doing the intro, don't go to my website. Go to my Facebook page because so much of the stuff that I put up is public and I do it for a reason. I do it so that people can really see from behind the scenes and on the ground, like what's going on with the clients that I work with. And I have the thrill of working with really amazing, diverse LGBTQ and HIV related clients.
So Kathy is spelled with a C for people that want to look up Kathy Renna on Facebook. How important do you feel media activism has been and is in the advancement of LGBTQ civil rights?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's a way to sort of understate the importance. I think that short of the personal conversations that individuals are having with their families and their colleagues and their neighbors, their whatever congregation they're in, their church or their synagogue, I think short of that direct personal knowledge of someone who's LGBTQ, the media is really the most powerful force in our culture. I mean, I always say all the time that, you know, if you want to change the culture, you've got to then change the laws. You got to use the media as a tool to educate. And I think that media, as I don't have to tell you, you live in Los Angeles, right? media is kind of the currency of cultural power. If you're not visible, what you're doing is not going to have nearly as much impact. And amplifying that impact by having the media cover issues and individuals, and frankly, from my perspective, just simply tell our stories as people and as communities is one of the most important things that's contributed to the incredible, unbelievable, in many ways, decade of success that we've seen.
In the mid-90s on my TV show in L.A., when I started working with Matt Scalarud and Fabrice Descendo, they were the founders of GayWire.com, and they remain internet pioneers today. Sure. But I would say to them and to my audience that the internet is allowing us to jump homophobic Hollywood gridlock and go directly to a global audience that wants and needs entertainment product for and about their lives. But to expand upon that, really, the internet allowed people on the front lines of our movement to connect with those deep in the closet, and it eliminated all of the gatekeepers that would keep us down.
That's right. And I think that one of my favorite things that Joan Gary, who was the executive director of GLAAD for many years, came on after I had been there for a while, but really brought the organization to national prominence with some incredible leadership. She used to say, this was at the very beginning of when the internet was something that we were starting to see grow and become a powerful force in the culture. She would always say, the internet's the only place you can be openly closeted. And she was absolutely right. And we've now seen what we can do with social media. And I talk to clients and I talk to fellow activists about this all the time. We can create our own media, and we can leverage social media to impact the way the more, quote unquote, mainstream media is writing about us and covering us, and how well they're doing that as well. So I think that the social media explosion has completely changed the way not only we do activism, but the way we connect as community, which is incredibly important given the fact that we are, as we all now understand full well, a global community. It's not just about what's happening in the United States. It's about what's happening in Africa. It's about what's happening in Europe. It's about what's happening in Eastern Europe and in Asia.
Completely. Now, I'm guessing because of how long I've known you and what you were doing when I met you, I'm going to guess you were in your mid-40s.
I just turned 50, actually.
Okay, well.
I'm a member of this AARP. As I like to joke, I'm eligible for the services of Sage, which is one of my clients.
Well, I am 53, and I think we're both well-preserved. But we've been, you know, for over half our lives, we've been activists.
Yeah, that's right.
And but recently, in recent years, you have had a direct connection to these Supreme Court miracles. I say miracles in jest. They're the result of lots of hard work and education and ultimate justice. But why don't you share with my audience your connection to the various plaintiffs and sort of your front row view of what has happened?
Sure. I mean, I think I've had the chance to work on issues particularly related to marriage equality, if you're talking about the Supreme Court, on a number of different levels. I got to work with local activists in D.C. when Washington, D.C. finally made marriage equality accessible to all couples in the District of Columbia, which was huge because, of course, it is the seat of our national government. I've also had the opportunity to, as you say, work with people who really are they're the Rosa Parkses of our movement. Edie Windsor, primarily, who I started working with actually after the decision. I was her publicist for about a year or so, and then I still work with her. I also work with her via Sage, who's a client, which is the LGBT National Advocacy and Services Organization for LGBT elders. And so, you know, it's just been incredible to, you know, every once in a while I just stop and think, wow, like I'm just driving in my car home from Philadelphia, but Edie Windsor's in the passenger seat, and I'm just chatting with her, and she's telling me all these amazing stories. And I'm thinking, who gets to sit next to and spend time with somebody like that, somebody who has changed history for all of us, who has made an incredible contribution? I'm so blessed. I'm so lucky. And, you know, she's just one example of the kinds of individuals that I've had the chance to interact with that way. And it really means a lot, because I think any role I can play in helping their story, not just get out there, but stay out there, it can be told in a way that really impacts the broad, all of us, the larger community and larger culture, that's why I do what I do.
June 25th, 2015 was the day that marriage equality came to the land, all 50 states. It's one of those days where, you know, people ask you, do you remember where you were when? And I think that you and I and so many people we know will always remember where we were on that day when that announcement came down. Where were you?
It's really ironic and kind of funny story. I was with a client. It was actually the city of Vancouver was doing some work working to increase LGBT tourism in Vancouver. So they wanted to do a breakfast with reporters in New York City. And that was the day that they planned on it. And I thought, oh, and by the way, part of their celebration and wanting to do this was that, you know, Canada has had marriage equality for a decade. So we're sitting there having breakfast with all these reporters. And I've got a, actually, you'll appreciate this. So I had a drag queen, you know, doing Marilyn Monroe, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And all of a sudden, all of our phones start going crazy. And, you know, within about 10 minutes after crying, hugging and cheering and having, you know, an early glass of champagne, I was like headed over to Al Jazeera to do an interview. And then I was over at the Sage offices and I was getting ready for the rally that we did at the Stonewall later that day with all of the marriage equality groups. And Edie Windsor was speaking and Michael Adams from Sage was speaking. So, you know, I was immediately, you know, thrown into it. And it's almost like it was a blur because like it's work, right? It's our jobs. We throw ourselves into it. And it's almost like I didn't have a chance to let it sink in on a personal level, what it really meant. And so it was actually like about 24 hours later that I was on Facebook and, you know, everybody was making the little rainbow background, you know, for their pictures for marriage equality. And I saw my wall and I realized that my 11-year-old cousin in Italy changed her profile background to a rainbow. And I was, that's when it really hit me. And I started to cry a little and just, you know, when we think about these moments when, where were you when? It's for some of us, it's a very, very interesting story. And it's something that is completely unforgettable.
I got goosebumps as you recounted that story and you talked about seeing your cousin's rainbow photo. The last count that I heard is that over 26 million people changed to that rainbow celebratory photo on Facebook.
And I think that we don't realize that Supreme Court decision, more than Windsor in many ways, had an international impact, maybe because of what's been happening in the last few years that we've been more interested in and more cohesive and more and working across international borders with other countries on issues. But it had an international impact. It energized pride celebrations around the world, because people look to the U.S. as a leader in civil rights. And for many of us, we know that it's been a long time coming, but and it's not quite so easy here as people might like to think sometimes. But the truth is it had a huge international impact. And that, you're right, the Facebook thing was just one sort of very specific kind of, you know, measurable example of it.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that, because one of the things that I was saying to people regarding the international impact is people do not realize how global our community is and how many binational relationships exist between U.S. citizens that are LGBT who are madly in love with people in other countries who have, you know, whose relationships have been inhibited or prohibited based upon the laws of the countries in which their partners are residing. And so now, just think of all the marriages that are happening in embassies throughout the world, and the opportunities that are coming to these couples that didn't have them before.
Well, I'll tell you a really quick story, and then we can maybe talk about other issues besides marriage, because there's so much more to do. But I was on a Olivia cruise with Edie Windsor, and there was a young couple on the cruise, and Don't ask me about how great it was to be on a cruise with Edie Windsor, like the best perk ever in my career, but whatever. So this young couple, fantastic, were in the audience and came up to me prior and said they wanted to talk to her and they had a letter for her. And I read the letter and I said, please tell your story in front of the whole audience. It was a panel discussion about leadership and marriage equality. And so this young couple stood up, and they were both from Iran. One was an American citizen, born here. The other is not. And they were had not been able to get married until the Windsor decision. If the Windsor decision hadn't happened, the young woman who was not an American citizen would have been deported. And because her family completely rejected her for being a lesbian, not only would she have been deported, she probably would have been executed. That is the penalty for being an out lesbian in Iran. And, you know, Edie was constantly meeting couples who said, we're a bi-national couple, and we would not be married today if it wasn't for you and for what you did. And they would just cry, and she would cry, and I would cry. And that's really something that I think a lot of people didn't realize was going to have such a huge, just a huge impact from the Windsor case, was this issue of bi-national couples. There are so many. So you're absolutely right. It's a really, really good point. But these two young women, they were in their 20s. And just the thought of it was just actually just so shocking. We had, you know, about 1,500 women sitting in that auditorium. And it really brought it home that this is about real people's lives. This is life and death. This is not, you know, this is not anything, as the right used to say, special rights, right? It's very real.
Completely. And, you know, another key point is that for those 1,500 women, they have a lot more privilege than a lot of people in the world. They have careers. That's right. They have the ability to be on a cruise. They have they're not going to be executed in their everyday lives. And for them to hear that story in that setting, is even more powerful when you look at that contrast.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
So on the day the Supreme Court decision came down, there were hashtag decision day events throughout the U.S. I went to one in Palm Springs. I actually am based in Palm Springs now, and I went to the Palm Springs decision day rally. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a soundbite from that day. I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, Kathy, I'm going to let you decide what we're talking about next. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. So at the decision in Palm Springs, council member Jenny Foat, who's an out lesbian and has been since she was elected to the council long ago, started her portion of the rally with this.
We couldn't start this rally without reading and rejoicing in the words of an Irish Catholic boy from Sacramento. And he said, "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. The judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit is reversed, and it is so ordered. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy."
And so the cheers keep coming around the country. I'm going to be back with Kathy Renna after this.
Did you know I'm an author? At the time of this recording, I have two books out. The first, a Living Powerfully with HIV memoir called Life Positive, A Journey to the Center of My Heart. It takes place throughout Asia and even in Palm Springs. It could be called Eat, Pray, Disclose. The second book, A Return to Brokeback Mountain, Photos and Interviews from the Historic Hollywood Premiere. To find these titles, go to NicholasSnowLive.com and click on Books in the main submenu. Hey folks, mark your calendars for early November because it's time for Greater Palm Springs Pride, Southern California's popular and longest-running LGBT festival in the Coachella Valley. Palm Canyon Drive is closed to traffic and transformed into a vibrant, pedestrian-friendly Pride Festival unique to Southern California. Palm Springs Pride is also one of the sponsoring organizations of the annual Harvey Milk Diversity Breakfast, which takes place every year in May. Visit pspride.org.
The LGBT Community Center of the Desert is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enriching the lives of the LGBT community in the Valley through health and wellness, social and educational programs. The center advances its mission through a clinical counseling and internship program, senior programming, youth anti-bullying and suicide prevention support programs, a growing volunteer program, and signature special events in the community for its members and allies. For more information on the LGBT Community Center, visit them on the web at thecenterps.org.
In Greater Palm Springs since 1979, the Desert Business Association has promoted and supported LGBT and allied businesses and professionals who join together for business promotion, economic development, educational, and humanitarian purposes. Their vision is to connect, promote, and build prosperity by embracing all members of the community to make a positive difference. They have many events every month. Find them at desertbusinessassociation.com.
This is Nicholas Snow Live, connecting the circuitry of humanity. Connect with us at NicholasSnowLive.com. It's not radio. It's gadio.
Hey, everybody. As you already know, because you've been listening, my guest today is Kathy Renna. She's the managing partner at Target Q, LLC. Find the website at Target Q. targetcue.com. But as Kathy said, Kathy with a C, find her on Facebook for kind of a front row seat to everything that's going on in the LGBT civil rights movement. You know, prior to Target Q, Kathy was the founder of Renna Communications, and over her 7 years with the firm, Renna Communications partnered with more than 50 different organizations, including the Matthew Shepard Foundation, Family Equality Council, the Point Foundation, ACT UP, the New York LGBT Center, Congregation Beth Simchat Torah, Soul Force, Senior Action in Gay Environment, which is SAGE, the Family Acceptance Project, the Williams Institute, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and so much more. I just wanted to brag about her a bit more. So, congratulations on the life that you have chosen to live.
Thank you. I appreciate that because it really was a choice every single step of the way. And at the beginning, at the top of the show, I know that my mic wasn't on, but I could hear you. And yes, I am an activist. I mean, I joke that I say I'm a publicist just to get a journalist on the phone with me, but I'm an activist. My clients know that. I certainly know that deep in my heart. And that's what drives me to do the work. I take that title proudly with a capital A.
I ultimately came up with a label that I love. And I refer to myself as a multimedia entertainment activist.
That's perfect for you. I don't think I'm that entertaining, but yes.
Well, the jury's out on whether or not I am. But my personal mission statement is to honor and express my creativity in a way that makes a difference.
That's awesome. And don't we wish everybody in Hollywood was like that? But sadly.
Well, the nice thing is that because of the collective work of leaders and heroes and heroines in the LGBTQ civil rights movement that millions of people have potential for their lives that didn't exist before.
Right.
So we've seen a lot of progress, but right now there's a lot of backlash at the marriage equality ruling. And the people who oppose us have never been more hateful or uglier, in my opinion. No,
they're desperate. They're getting desperate.
So what do you think is next?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I always think of my career in activism in general. It's kind of like driving a car. Like you want to always have your eyes on the road and know what to look at what's ahead of you, but you want to kind of keep your eyes on the rearview mirror. So I'm a huge, huge proponent of us acknowledging our history as LGBT people. I work on a lot of things related to history. I just worked on that 50th anniversary of the annual reminder pickets in Philadelphia by Barbara Giddings, Frank Kameny, and dozens of others that happened well before Stonewall, but because they didn't get as much media attention at the time, and this goes back to, you know, sort of how important and critical media is, everybody thinks that our movement basically started with Stonewall. And so that's important to me. But at the same time, that was an opportunity for people who were the original picketers in 1964, like Ada Bello and John James and others who are still with us, to meet people like Edie Windsor. And then to have Edie Windsor meet Judy Shepard for the first time and Dennis Shepard. And then to have them meet young people who are doing the work today and sort of connect all of that. Because what everyone started talking about almost immediately after the Supreme Court decision on the 25th was, okay, what's next? You know, we have no federal job protections. You know, we have a tremendous amount of work to do on transgender issues. And there are certain populations in our very, very diverse community, like youth and seniors, bisexual people, for whom there is a tremendous amount of work and education that needs to get them done, that have issues that impact their lives that are incredibly under-resourced and that require a tremendous amount of attention and education.
And, you know, a key point about what part of what you talk about is the need for an Employment Non-Discrimination Act across the board, because there are people that, as they've said some in so many sound bites, can get married today and fired from their job tomorrow.
I said it myself. I mean, it was literally minutes after the decision. I was like live on Al Jazeera because I ran over to the studio from, you know, in Chelsea to by Penn Station. And I said, you know, you could get married on Friday, put your Facebook pictures up of your wedding on Saturday and get fired on Monday when you go in the office. And so that's a serious issue. That's something that we need to really think about. There's a tremendous amount of education needs to be done, even within our own community. People don't realize that in over 30 states, you can be fired for your perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. So it's a tremendous problem, and it's time that we start really looking at ways to make it happen.
Well, the other important thing, and you alluded to this earlier, is that none of us are free until all of us are free. And the LGBTQ civil rights movement is a worldwide movement. And there's a hugely stark contrast to the civil liberties that exist for those of us in the United States versus, as you mentioned, the countries in which being perceived to be LGBTQ is punishable by death.
Well, and there are also countries where there are more rights provided to LGBT people than here in the U.S. So, you know, we're not first on the list by any means.
No,
so
we have
countries to learn from, and we certainly have a lot to. I think what we have here is just a certain amount of, for better or worse, cultural influence worldwide. So, you know, when we have something happen here in the U.S. that's a step forward, it resonates around the world. Even if it's as simple as, you know, as you well know, being in Hollywood, having a celebrity, you know, like when Ellen DeGeneres came out in 1997, that was, you remember that, I remember that. It was incredible. It was huge. And it was really the beginning of a whole new time where we started to see a lot more visibility. And the late 90s were really the beginning of leading into this decade of progress that we've seen that is really, I mean, I feel like, again, not to, you know, with the car analogy, I do like to drive and have a sports car. But, you know, it's like if somebody put the foot on the gas for the LGBT movement in the last decade. I mean, we are making progress so fast. It's incredible. But we still have some huge things to deal with. And the job discrimination one is something a lot of gay people don't even know about. So it's really important that that becomes a priority for our organizations and for anybody involved in the movement.
You know, I love this cook metaphor because you were talking about the importance of people realizing that Stonewall was not the beginning of it all. And you were just celebrating 50 years of activism. And those activists, they built the car.
That's
and
right.
Stonewall is when they started the engine.
Exactly. That's actually really good. I mean, one of the ways I described it to journalists who weren't super aware of the work of Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings it was kind of like the Revolutionary War, and the Stonewall was kind of like the Boston Tea Party. The Boston Tea Party certainly wasn't the beginning of the Revolutionary War. The founding fathers were starting things, and yet it was all fathers back then. We're starting, you know, long before to fight. So it's just a matter of context, and it's a matter of helping people understand. It was all important, and things happen in very, very different ways, and there are different, you know, there, we all want to end up in the same place, so there are different ways to get there. But I think it's important that we honor all of the people that contributed. And even before, you know, the 50th celebration that we did, before that, Mattachine had started before that. And frankly, you know, go back to Magnus Hirschfeld, go back to the 30s in Germany, and, you know, the times when there was the beginnings of a very vibrant and active LGBT, well, then primarily really gay and lesbian, but LGBT culture, and people who were trying to come out of the closet and start to live their lives authentically. And we all stand on their shoulders. There's no question. I don't do anything without thinking about the fact that I had the opportunity and was so blessed to actually know Barbara Gittings. And that I want to make sure that my daughter, who is going to be 10 in September, you know, I hope that by the time she gets to high school, which isn't that long, seems increasingly shorter period of time, picks up a history book, and that Harvey Milk is in it, that Barbara Gittings is in it, that Frank Kameny is in it, that Bayard Rustin is in it. You know, that's the kind of stuff that is really important to me from the history perspective.
You know, speaking of history and this car metaphor, in the car metaphor, you know, we talked about the people that built the car and Stonewall's when they started the engine. And actually, the car is more like a bus. And, you know, those of at some point, you and I got on that bus. I had the opportunity to be on staff for the first ever National Coming Out Day in 1988. And of course, in the 90s is when you started your work with GLAAD, which I believe is when you and I first met.
It is.
And one of the things that amazes me is how the dots connect. So, for example, one of the photos that accompanies this podcast on the online layout was taken at a media event, a press conference in Laramie, Wyoming. I think it was the day that Matthew Shepard died. And then you went on to actually work very closely with Matthew's parents, which you could never have forecast at the time. Why don't you take us back to that day in Laramie, Wyoming, and talk about how you ended up being there and what you recall and how your journey continued to connect you more deeply and personally with Matthew's parents?
Absolutely. It's probably, in many ways, the most influential kind of moment in time, sort of single issue, single incident, really in my career. I think I based so much of how I do what I do on the things that I learned after Matthew was attacked. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, and the internet was just sort of, it was a relatively new-ish thing. And I was actually at the National Press Club for a press conference being held by one of those groups with the words family, research, council, traditional, whatever. They were doing a press conference about ex-gays, and they're going to do a new big campaign about ex-gays. And I came back to the office to dozens of emails, all these voicemails, you know, I think I had a beeper. We didn't really even have cell phones back then, about this young man who'd been found in Wyoming, beaten very, very badly, and that it was potentially a hate crime. And I got a phone call within, I don't know, 12 to 24 hours from a guy named Jim Osborne, who is still my friend to this day. He's an amazing person. He was the president of the LGBT student group at the University of Wyoming. He was Matt's friend. And he called me and he said, you know, essentially, we're hiding in the student union because we're surrounded by press. There are all kinds of cameras here. We don't know what to do. You know, they're kids. And I said, what can I do? And he said, and this is, I think I can say this, get on a fucking plane, was what he said.
This is internet radio. You can say whatever you want.
Anyway, I'm from New York. But that's what he said. And so I did, because I talked to Joan Gary, who was the head of, fairly new head of GLAAD at the time. And she said to me, I'll never forget, she said, do you think this is going to be really big and important? And I said, yes, without a second's hesitation. So I got on a plane and I was out there. And as most people know, he was on life support and he survived another 4 or 5 days. But I literally was there on the ground right after 48 hours, not even after they found him. And the morning that he died overnight. And that morning we put together a press conference with his friends, fellow students, community members, local organizations who were, you know, at this point, increasingly overwhelmed by the amount of media coverage. We started to see hundreds of vigils popping up around the country. And, you know, it was really, it was like nothing I'd ever experienced. And I came back to Washington. I brought Jim with me. There was a rally and a really memorial on the steps of the U.S. Capitol with a tremendous amount of very high profile elected officials. All of our national LGBT organizations were involved in putting it together quickly. Many celebrities, including Ellen DeGeneres, who came, and she was in tears and said, I came out so that stuff like this wouldn't happen. And it was about 25,000 people showed up to this thing. It was really moving. And I think a few months later, I had not had any contact with the Shepherds at that point because they asked us, you know, to give them their privacy. So we did. But several months later, I got a phone call in Washington and it was Judy Shepherd. And she said, we're ready to tell our story. Can you help us? And I said, yeah, I think we can probably help with that. And that was the beginning of our relationship. She came to the GLAAD Awards that spring. And since then, I've worked closely with them, whether it was through GLAAD or, you know, personally, they were a client. They've been a client on and off. I've been on their advisory board. I spent last weekend with them in Philadelphia. The work that she and Dennis and their family have done, what they've sacrificed, absolutely incredible. And it's really simple. Why? Not just because they dearly love their son. And as she often says, this should be him up at this podium, not me. But because she realized that she had a platform that most parents, most families put in that horrific situation for years, decades, had never had. And we would talk about why that is. It's probably a whole nother show. You can have me back on. But she realized that they had an opportunity to reach people and educate because of who Matt was. And so it's immeasurable the change that's happened because of the work that they've done. And my relationship with them has been just, they're like family and I would do anything for them. And they're just incredible, amazing people, yet they are also the most ordinary people in the world. They're just, you know, we went out for dinner after everything was all said and done in Philly. And it was, you know, we caught up on stuff and we talked a little bit of shop, but you know, mostly it was like, how's your family? What are you up to? What are you doing this summer? Like, they're just amazing people. But they also are just regular folks, which is really that's the moral of this whole story, is that that's the truth for so many of us. And that's what we're striving for.
You know, the term bittersweet comes to mind, and with all the joy that we're experiencing as a community, there is also a lot of sadness because we know the price that was paid.
Sure.
We know the price that was paid by the people who died of AIDS. AIDS ripped open closet doors. It built bridges that would not have existed without the tragedy of that disease. And of course, there's, you know, the victims of murder in our community, and there are two sides to this coin, and so it is bittersweet. And so many of the activists that I've been communicating with that have been around for a long time have been talking about the people we've lost and what it would be like for them to see this day and the fact that we're having this day because of their sacrifices.
Oh, I totally agree. If your listeners haven't seen it, I highly recommend finding a way to see the documentary that HBO just did about Larry Kramer. In fact, I watched it last night with my girlfriend, and I know Larry. I've known him for a long time, worked with him in ACT UP, and he's an incredible person, a complicated person. But there is no doubt that without his work, we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are today. And I've often said this, and I was doing an interview with, I can't remember who, after the marriage stuff, that was asking, you know, about sort of the history and the movement, and how have we made so much progress so quickly? And I said, it's kind of like this horrific dark cloud with this very bittersweet, as you say, a silver lining, which is that if it hadn't been for AIDS, our community would not be as out and organized and cohesive and powerful as we are, because we were forced to. We had no choice. Nobody gave a shit about people who were dying of AIDS. Lesbians came to the, you know, rushing to help, to care for the gay men and bisexual men who were sick and dying. Nobody else cared. The government didn't care. And it brought us together as a community, and we realized we better get our stuff organized here, because if we don't do it, we're going to be sitting here waiting for somebody else to do it, and that's not going to happen.
The documentary to which you refer is Larry Kramer, In Love and Anger. And it's on HBO this month and available on HBO Go as well. Did you just say you watched it with your girlfriend?
We just watched it last night, yeah.
So when is your girlfriend becoming your wife?
That's a good question. I would jokingly say ask her, but that would probably get me in trouble. So I don't know.
I put you on the spot.
The important thing is that it's an option for everybody now, whether you want to or not. Everybody has access.
I completely concur. So we have 5 to 10 minutes left. We don't have to use all of it, but I would like to use as much of it as you want to talk about anything that you think that is worthy of addressing in this episode that we haven't yet touched upon.
Sure. Oh, I could talk to you all day, Nick.
Well, you know what? Believe it or not, I've been thinking in the back of my head since having a front row seat to your life on Facebook that you need to be a regular contributor to my show and come on whenever you want.
I used to do a lot of this when I worked at GLAAD. I used to go on the O'Reilly Factor, which, you know, have to take a shower right after, but I used to go on the O'Reilly Factor because it was important, because his audience was, I didn't care about him that much. I wasn't going to change his mind, but the audience was important. And so, you know, I love doing this. So I'm happy to come on and talk anytime, but I think, you know, just a couple of examples of, I think, where we still need to go. So we talked about job stuff. I think, you know, anybody who's not living under a rock has seen that transgender issues have become incredibly put into the sort of the forefront with people like Laverne Cox and Janet Mox and then Caitlyn Jenner. And as someone who's been working in the trenches and working with trans activists for decades, I remember we had a hate murder of a trans woman in Washington, D.C. Our Washington, D.C. GLAAD chapter was the first one to have a transgender board member. This was, again, the early to mid-90s. We have come so far, but there's so much that needs to be done. And I think the issue of kids coming out younger and younger and younger generally, but particularly trans kids, is going to be something that all of us will be seeing a lot more of. And I think more progress needs to be made. Although we just saw in the last couple of days, this issue of transgender service in the military. Wow. I mean, I worked on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I did not expect that to happen so quickly. After Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, I thought, well, transgender service members, that'll happen. It'll take us another 5-10 years. It was like a year ago, 2 years ago. So that's really amazing. And then again, it's like all the other populations in our community that, because of, as you referenced before, privilege, they, as I say, you do the math, you know, they just don't have as much privilege. People of color, young people, older people. I do a lot of work with homeless LGBT youth. I'm thrilled that on Monday in New York City, we're going to break ground for the B. Arthur residence, which is going to be the first residence owned by the Ali Frenay Center, which is the largest LGBT homeless youth services organization in the country. They're just incredible. And on Monday, we're going to break ground on the first building that they're actually going to own, which sounds great, but really, it's 2015, and we're still fighting with New York City constantly, as you are in LA and other places, for just enough beds to deal with the fact that 40% of the kids on the street are queer. That is so ridiculously disproportionate. And to me, leads directly into another issue I work on a tremendous amount with the Family Acceptance Project, which is dealing with kids coming out now younger and younger, average age 12, 13, and how their families react and how their families can play a role in ensuring their health and safety and well-being by decreasing rejection, increasing acceptance, and fostering good family relationship. And that's really still a big issue. It's not easy to come out still for so many people. And then the other issue, which again, I just had the privilege on Monday of working with SAGE. They were at the White House Conference on Aging. It happens every 10 years. 10 years ago, we had a fight to get one delegate. This year, we were invited. We were involved in the policy discussions. We had 4 delegates. We had one of my favorite people in the world, Sandy Warshaw, stand up and say, as a Jewish lesbian, feminist, New Yorker who's 82 years old. She was awesome. The whole place just cheered. She talked about what matters to her as an older lesbian whose fear is that she may end up being in a housing situation where she's going to have to go back in the closet. Because that's a real issue that's still very prevalent. So, and we walked out of that conference with changes in HUD regulations, with a way of being more inclusive with the Older Americans Act that President Obama is trying to get them to vote on and to put back into law. So, you know, to think about the fact that we've got a whole generation of older LGBT Americans who are, they're looking around saying, wow, I never expected marriage in my time. But they're also looking around saying, where am I going to live? Who's going to take care of me? You know, they didn't grow up in a generation where they had a tremendous amount of family support at all. And they didn't have kids nearly as often as we did. I'm banking on my kid helping take care of me when I get older. This generation, they don't have kids. And so they don't have grandchildren or children. And it's a big issue. So I hope that, you know, what I really try and do in my work at the end of the day, like whether it's this interview or whether it's with a client trying to get their story into something, it's having whoever's on the receiving end of the message say, I never thought about it that way. And if I can do that, then I feel like I've accomplished something. So if the folks that are listening to this are saying, oh, wow, I never really thought about old gay people or, you know, queer kids on the street and what they have to deal with, that's a win for me.
Opening hearts and minds. You know, one of the fascinating things, and this is fodder for a completely new episode, but one of the fascinating things for me regarding the issue of transgender individuals is the realization that gender identity has nothing to do with what someone looks like, has nothing to do with whether or not they have gone through any sort of sexual reassignment medical procedures. It completely has to do with who someone believes themselves to be and knows themselves to be internally.
Right. That's right.
And when you grasp that, and you see a world that accepts and embraces that, you see that there's so much more freedom that exists for every human being of all walks of life. Because if there's anything that takes that removes boxes and labels, it's that reality.
Well, that's right. And I think the other thing that a lot of folks, even in our community, don't think about is that transphobia, homophobia, biphobia, it all comes out of sexism. It's all about sexism. And so, you know, when people say the T doesn't necessarily belong, it's not the same as sexual orientation, we're in this together. Because frankly, when I experience any kind of, whatever you want to call it, discrimination, pushback, somebody kind of looks at me the wrong way, you know, somebody's not very nice to me, it's because of my gender expression. I mean, you can't tell someone's gay from looking at them. We can have a whole other show, right? But the truth is that that's increasingly the case. We're a very diverse community, and it's really all about sexism. And we need to raise our consciousness as a community around that and make that connection. Because I think that a lot of us suffer and have suffered and will continue to suffer until we get with the program. And there's a young generation coming up that's going to kick our butts because they're all about fluidity and they don't care. And I don't want to use pronouns. And, you know, they're going to teach us, and we're going to learn the hard way unless we get with the program, that we really need to rethink the gender binary and the spectrum of sexual orientation. It's not, you know, it's not black and white. There's a ton of gray, and we need to all be more comfortable living in that gray, as I like to say, which I always have, but I think for a lot of people, it's not that easy.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I cannot wait to have you back.
I'm thrilled to come back anytime you want.
I'm gonna let you go now, but I'm gonna conclude with playing my original LGBTQ civil rights anthem. It's called Stonewalls. This is a digitized recording from a live performance I did in 1998. The first line of the song is, for over 25 years throughout every season. At the time in 1998, it had been 25 years since the Stonewall riots. But in my introduction to the song that night in 1998, I talked about how the movement had really been gone on a lot longer. So here it is, Stonewalls.
For over 25 years, throughout every season, we've been fighting together every day and night. 'Cause for prejudice, there is no rhyme, no reason.
Listening to Nicholas Snow Live. Find all of our advertisers and everything Nicholas Snow at NicholasSnowLive.com. Nicholas uses both Twitter and Facebook to alert listeners just as he's going on the air. Anytime 24/7, you may direct tweet at The Nicholas Snow or post your questions, comments, breaking news, and gossip on The Nicholas Snow Live Facebook page. Nicholas may very well discuss your tweet or comment on the air. For all of his social media links, visit NicholasSnowLive.com and click on Social Networks in the main submenu. This show is produced and copyrighted by Nicholas Snow Productions, LLC. All rights reserved. Thank you for being a part of the snowstorm. We are honored by your presence.